Well, now, I really have nothing to say to people who pretend to do prophecies. Lucas! Prophecies are without a doubt one of the most villainous tricks which rascals like you play upon honest men. Magic cannot see into the future, and magicians who claimed otherwise were liars. Lucas! Vinculus looked around. I hear you have all the books that were ever written upon magic, he said. And it is commonly reported that you've even got back the ones that were lost when the Library of Alexandria burnt, and know them all by heart, I dare say. Books and papers are the basis of good scholarship and sound knowledge, declared Mr. Norrell primly. Magic is to be put on the same footing as the other disciplines. Vinculus leaned suddenly forward and bent over Mr. Norrell with a look of the most intense, burning concentration. Without quite meaning to, Mr. Norrell fell silent, and he leaned towards Vinculus to hear whatever Vinculus was about to confide to him.
I reached out my hand, whispered Vinculus. England's rivers turned and flowed the other way.
I beg your pardon?
I reached out my hand, said Vinculus a little louder. My enemy's blood stopped in their veins.
He straightened himself, opened wide his arms, and closed his eyes as if in a religious ecstasy of some sort. In a strong, clear voice, full of passion, he continued.
I reached out my hand. Thought and memory flew out of my enemies' heads like a flock of starlings. My enemies crumpled like empty sacks. I came to them out of mists and rain. I came to them in dreams at midnight. I came to them in a flock of ravens that filled a northern sky at dawn. When they thought themselves safe, I came to them in a cry that broke the silence of a winter wood.
Yes, yes, interrupted Mr. Norrell. Do you really suppose that this sort of nonsense is new to me? Every madman on every street corner screams out the same threadbare gibberish, and every vagabond with a yellow curtain tries to make himself mysterious by reciting something of the sort. It is in every third-rate book on magic published in the last 200 years. I came to them in a flock of ravens. What does that mean, I should like to know? Who came to who in a flock of ravens?
Lucas!
Vinculus ignored him. His strong voice overpowered Mr. Norrell's weak, shrill one.
The rain made a door for me, and I went through it. The stones made a throne for me, and I sat upon it. 3 kingdoms were given to me to be mine forever. England was given to me to be mine forever. The nameless slave wore a silver crown. The nameless slave was a king in a strange country.
3 kingdoms, exclaimed Mr. Norrell. Ha! Now I understand what this nonsense pretends to be. A prophecy of the Raven King. Well, I'm sorry to tell you that if you hope to impress me by recounting tales of that gentleman, you will be disappointed. Oh, yes, you are entirely mistaken. There is no magician whom I detest more.
Footnote 1. The Raven King was traditionally held to have possessed 3 kingdoms, one in England, one in Faerie, and Ankh, a strange country on the far side of hell.
The weapons that my enemies raised against me are venerated in hell as holy relics. Plans that my enemies made against me are preserved as holy texts. Blood that I shed upon ancient battlefields is scraped from the stained earth by hell's sacristans and placed in a vessel of silver and ivory. I gave magic to England, a valuable inheritance, but Englishmen have despised my gift. Magic shall be written upon the sky by the rain, but they shall not be able to read it. Magic shall be written in the faces of the stony hills, but their minds shall not be able to contain it. In winter the barren trees shall be a black writing, but they shall not understand it.
It is every Englishman's birthright to be served by competent and well-educated magicians, interrupted Mr. Norrell. What do you offer them instead? Mystical ramblings about stones and rains and trees. This is like God bless who told us that we should learn magic from wild beasts in the forests. Why not pigs in the sty, or stray dogs, I wonder? This is not the sort of magic which civilized men wish to see practiced in England nowadays.
He glared furiously at Vinculus, and as he did so, something caught his eye. And Vinculus had dressed himself with no particular care. His dirty neckcloth had been negligently wound about his neck, and a little gap of unclean skin showed between neckcloth and shirt. In that space was a curious curving mark of a vivid blue, not unlike the upward stroke of a pen. It might have been a scar, the relic of a street brawl, perhaps. But what it most resembled was that barbaric painting of the skin which is practiced by the natives of the South Sea Islands. Curiously, Vinculus, who was able to stand entirely at his ease in another man's house railing at him, seemed embarrassed by this mark, and when he saw Mr. Norrell had observed it, he put his hand to his throat and plucked at the cloth to hide it.
Two magicians shall appear in England!
A sort of exclamation broke from Mr. Norrell, an exclamation that began as a cry and ended as a soft, unhappy sigh.
The first shall fear me, the second shall long to behold me. The first shall be governed by thieves and murderers, the second shall conspire at his own destruction. The first shall bury his heart in a dark wood beneath the snow, yet still feel its ache. The second shall see his dearest possession in his enemy's hand. Oh, now I know that you've come here with no other aim but to wound me. False magician, you are jealous of my success. You cannot destroy my magic, and so you are determined to blacken my name and destroy my peace. The first shall pass his life alone. He shall be his own jailer. The second shall tread lonely roads, the storm above his head, seeking a dark tower upon a high hillside.
Just then the door opened, and two men ran in.
Lucas! Davy! Screeched Mr. Norrell hysterically. Where have you been?
Lucas began to explain something about the bell cord.
What? Oh, seize hold of him, quickly!
Davy, Mr. Norrell's coachman, was built on the same generous scale as others of his profession, and had the strength that comes from daily opposing his will to that of four high-bred coach-horses in the prime of life. He took hold of Vinculus around his body and his throat. Vinculus struggled energetically. He did not neglect, in the meantime, to continue berating Mr. Norrell.
I sit upon a black throne in the shadows, but they shall not see me. The rain shall make a door for me, and I shall pass through it. The stones shall make a throne for me, and I shall sit upon it.
Davy and Vinculus careered against a little table, upsetting a pile of books that stood upon it.
Be careful, exclaimed Mr. Norrell. For God's sake, be careful. He'll knock over that inkpot. He'll damage my books.
Lucas joined Davy in endeavouring to pinion Vinculus's wild, windmilling arms, while Mr. Norrell scampered around the library a great deal faster than anyone had seen him move for many years, gathering up books and putting them out of harm's way.
The nameless slave shall wear a silver crown,
gasped Vinculus, Davy's arm tightening about his throat, rendering his oration decidedly less impressive than before.
Vinculus made one last effort and pulled the upper part of his body free of Davy's grasp and shouted,
The nameless slave shall be king in a strange country.
Then Lucas and Davy half pulled, half carried him out of the room. Mr. Norrell went and sat down in the chair by the fire. He picked up his book again, but he found that he was a great deal too agitated to return to his reading. He fidgeted about, bit his fingernails, walked about the room, returned constantly to those volumes which had been displaced in the struggle, and examined them for signs of damage. There were none. But most of all, he went to the windows and peered out anxiously to see if anyone was watching the house. At 3 o'clock, the room began to grow dusky. Lucas returned to light the candles and mend the fire, and just behind him was Childermas.
Ha! Cried Mr. Norrell. At last! Have you heard what happened? I am betrayed on all sides. Other magicians keep watch upon me and plot my downfall. My idle servants forget their duties. It is a matter of complete indifference to them whether my throat is cut or not. And as for you, you villain, you are the very worst of all. I tell you, this man appeared so suddenly in the room as if by magic. And when I rang the bell and cried out, no one came. You must put aside all your other work. Your only task now is to discover what spells this man employed to gain entry to the house. Where did he learn his magic? What does he know?
Childermas gave his master an ironical look.
Well, if that is my only task, it is done already. There was no magic. One of the kitchen maids left the pantry window open, and the sorcerer climbed in and crept about the house until he found you. That is all. No one came because he had cut the bell cord, and Lucas and the others did not hear you shout. They heard nothing until he started to rant, and then they came immediately. Is that not so, Lucas?
Lucas, kneeling at the hearth with a poker in his hand, agreed that that was exactly how it had been.
And so I tried to tell you, sir, only you would not listen.
Mr. Norrell had worked himself up into such a frenzy of anxiety over Vinculus's supposed magical powers but this explanation had at first little power to soothe him.
"Oh," he said, "but still I am certain he means me harm. Indeed, he has done me great harm already."
"Yes," agreed Childermas, "very great harm, for while he was in the pantry, he ate 3 meat pies."
"And 2 cream cheeses,"
added Lucas. Mr. Norrell was forced to admit to himself that this did not seem much like the actions of a great magician, but still he could not be entirely easy until he had vented his anger upon someone. Childermas and Lucas being most conveniently to hand, he began with them, and treated them to a long speech full of invective against Vinculus as the greatest villain who had ever lived, and ending with several strong hints about the bad ends that impudent and neglectful servants came to. Childermas and Lucas, who had been obliged to listen to something of this sort practically every week since they'd entered Mr. Norrell's service, felt no particular alarm, but merely waited until their master had talked out his displeasure. Whereupon Childermas said, "Leaving aside the pies and the cheeses, he has put himself to a great deal of trouble, and risked a hanging to pay you this visit. What did he want?"
"Oh, to deliver a prophecy of the Raven King's. Hardly an original idea. It was quite as impenetrable as such ramblings generally are. There was something about a battlefield, and something about a throne, and something about a silver crown. But the chief burden of what he had to say was to boast of another magician, by which I suppose he meant himself."
Now that Mr. Norrell was reassured that Vinculus was not a terrible rival, he began to regret that he'd ever been led on to argue with him. It would have been far better, he thought, to maintain a lofty and magisterial silence. He comforted himself with the reflection that Vinculus had looked a great deal less imposing when Lucas and Davy were dragging him from the room. Gradually this thought, and the consciousness of his own infinitely superior education and abilities, began to make him feel comfortable again. But alas, such comfort was short-lived. For on taking up the language of birds again, he came upon the following passage. "There is nothing else in magic but the wild thought of the bird as it casts itself into the void. There is no creature upon the earth with such potential for magic. Even the least of them may fly straight out of this world and come by chance to the other lands. Where does the wind come from that blows upon your face, that fans the pages of your book? Where the heron-scarum magic of small wild creatures meets the magic of man, where the language of the wind and the rain and the trees can be understood, there we will find the Raven King." Footnote 2. Thomas Lanchester, Treatise Concerning the Language of Birds, Chapter 6. The next time that Mr. Norrell saw Lord Portishead, which happened 2 days later, he immediately went up to his lordship and addressed him with the following words.
"I hope, my lord, that you will have some very sharp things to say about Thomas Lanchester in the periodical. For years I had admired the language of birds as a valiant attempt to place before the readers a clear and comprehensive description of the magic of the Orient magicians. But upon closer examination, I find his writing is tainted with their worst characteristics. He is mystical, my lord. He is mystical."
Chapter 14. Heartbreak Farm, January 1808. Some 30 years before Mr. Norrell arrived in London with a plan to astonish the world by restoring English magic, a gentleman named Lawrence Strange came into his inheritance. This comprised a house in an almost ruinous state, some barren lands, and a mountain of debts and mortgages. These were grave ills indeed. But, thought Lawrence Strange, they were nothing that the acquisition of a very large sum of money might not cure, and so, like many other gentlemen before him and after him, he made it his business to be particularly agreeable to an heiress whenever he met with any. And being a handsome man with elegant manners and a clever way of talking, in no time at all he had captivated a Miss Urquhartstoun, a young Scottish lady with £900 a year. With the money Miss Urquhartstoun brought him, Lawrence Strange repaired his house, improved his lands, and repaid his debts. Soon he began to make money instead of owing it. He extended his estate and lent out money at 15%. In these and other similar pursuits, he found occupation for every waking hour. He could no longer be at the trouble of showing his bride much attention. Indeed, he made it quite plain that her society and conversation were irksome to him, and she, poor thing, had a very hard time of it. Lawrence Strange's estate was in Shropshire,
in a retired part of the country near the Welsh border. Mrs. Strange knew no one there. She was accustomed to city life, to Edinburgh balls and Edinburgh shops, and the clever conversation of her Edinburgh friends. The sight of the high, gloomy hills, forever shrouded in Welsh rain, was very dispiriting. She bore with this lonely existence for 5 years, before dying of a chill she had caught while taking a solitary walk on those same hills in a storm. Mr. and Mrs. Strange had one child, who was, at the time of his mother's death, about 4 years of age. Mrs. Strange had not been buried more than a few days, when this child became the subject of a violent quarrel between Lawrence Strange and his late wife's family. The Erkestoons maintained that in accordance with the terms of the marriage settlement, a large part of Mrs. Strange's fortune must now be put aside for her son for him to inherit at his majority. Lawrence Strange, to no one's very great surprise, claimed that every penny of his wife's money was his to do with as he liked. Both parties consulted lawyers, and two separate lawsuits were started, one in the Doctors' Commons in London and one in the Scottish courts. The two lawsuits, Strange versus Erkestoon and Erkestoon versus Strange, went on for years and years, and during this time, the very sight of his son became displeasing to Lawrence Strange. It seemed to him that the boy was like a boggy field or a copse full of diseased trees, worth money on paper, but failing to yield a good annual return. If English law had entitled Lawrence Strange to sell his son and buy a better one, he probably would have done it. Footnote 1. Eventually, both lawsuits were decided in favour of Lawrence Strange's son. Meanwhile, the Erkestoons realised that Lawrence Strange had it in his power to make his son every bit as unhappy as his wife had been. So Mrs. Strange's brother wrote urgently to Lawrence Strange, suggesting that the boy spend some part of every year at his own house in Edinburgh. To Mr. Erkestoon's great surprise, Mr. Strange made no objection. Footnote 2. Upon the contrary, Lawrence Strange congratulated himself on avoiding paying for the boy's food and clothes for months at a time. So may love of money make an intelligent man small-minded and ridiculous. So it was that Jonathan Strange spent half of every year of his childhood at Mr. Erkestoon's house in Charlotte Square in Edinburgh, where, it is to be presumed, he learnt to hold no very high opinion of his father. There he received his early education in the company of his three cousins, Margaret, Maria, and Georgiana Erkestoon. Footnote 3. Strange's biographer, John Segundis, observed on several occasions how Strange preferred the society of clever women to that of men. Life of Jonathan Strange, publisher John Murray, London, 1820. Edinburgh is certainly one of the most civilized cities in the world, and the inhabitants are full as clever and as fond of pleasure as those in London. Whenever he was with them, Mr. and Mrs. Erkestoon did everything they could to make him happy, hoping, in this way, to make up for the neglect and coldness he met at his father's house. And so it is not to be wondered at if he grew up a little spoiled, a little fond of his own way, and a little inclined to think well of himself. Lawrence Strange grew older and richer, but no better. A few days before Mr. Norrell's interview with Vinculus, a new manservant came to work at Lawrence Strange's house. The other servants were very ready with help and advice. They told the new manservant that Lawrence Strange was proud and full of malice, that everybody hated him, that he loved money beyond anything, and that he and his son had barely spoken to each other for years and years. They also said that he had a temper like the devil, and that on no account whatsoever must the new manservant do anything to offend him, or things would go the worse for him. The new manservant thanked them for the information, and promised to remember what they'd said. But what the servants didn't know was that the new manservant had a temper to rival Mr. Strange's own, that he was sometimes sarcastic, often rude, and that he had a very high opinion of his own abilities, and a correspondingly low one of other people's. The new manservant did not mention his failings to the other servants for the simple reason that he knew nothing of them. Though he often found himself quarrelling with his friends and neighbours, he was always puzzled to discover the reason, and always supposed that it must be their fault. But in case you should imagine that this chapter will treat of none but disagreeable persons, it ought to be stated at once that whereas malice was the beginning and end of Lawrence Strange's character, the new manservant was a more natural blend of light and shade. He possessed a great deal of good sense, and was energetic in defending others from real injury, as he was in revenging imaginary insults to himself. Lauren Strange was old and rarely slept much. Indeed, it would often happen that he found himself more lively at night than during the day, and he would sit up at his desk writing letters and conducting his business. Naturally, one of the servants always sat up as well, and a few days after he had first entered the household, this duty fell to the new manservant. All went well until a little after 2 o'clock in the morning, when Mr. Strange summoned the new manservant and asked him to fetch a small glass of sherry wine. Unremarkable as this request was, the new manservant did not find it at all easy to accomplish. Having searched for the sherry wine in the usual places, he was obliged to wake first the maid and ask her where the butler's bedroom might be, and next the butler and ask him where the sherry wine was kept. Even then the new manservant had to wait some moments more while the butler talked out his surprise that Mr. Strange should ask for sherry wine, a thing he hardly ever took. Mr. Strange's son, Mr. Jonathan Strange, added the butler, for the new manservant's better understanding of the household, was very fond of sherry wine, and generally kept a bottle or two in his dressing room. In accordance with the butler's instructions, the new manservant fetched the sherry wine from the cellars, a task which involved much lighting of candles, much walking down long stretches of dark, cold passageways, much brushing of dirty old cobwebs from his clothes, much knocking of his head against rusty old implements hanging from musty old ceilings, and much wiping of blood and dirt from his face afterwards. He brought the glass to Mr. Strange, who drank it straight down, and asked for another. The new manservant felt that he'd seen enough of the cellars for one night, and so, remembering what the butler had said, he went upstairs to the dressing room of Mr. Jonathan Strange. Entering cautiously, he found the room apparently unoccupied, but with candles still burning. This did not particularly surprise the new manservant, who knew that conspicuous among the many vices peculiar to rich, unmarried gentlemen is wastefulness of candles. He began to open drawers and cupboards, pick up chamber pots and look into them, look under tables and chairs and peer into flower vases. And if you are at all surprised by all the places into which the new manservant looked, then all I can say is that he had more experience of rich, unmarried gentlemen than you do, and knew that their management of household affairs is often characterized by a certain eccentricity. He found the bottle of sherry wine, much as he had expected, performing the office of a bootjack inside one of its owner's boots. As the new manservant poured the wine into the glass, he happened to glance into a mirror that was hanging on the wall and discovered that the room was not, after all, empty. Jonathan Strange was seated in a high-backed, high-shouldered chair, watching everything that the new manservant did with a look of great astonishment upon his face. The new manservant said not a word in explanation, for what explanation could he have given that a gentleman would have listened to? A servant would have understood him in an instant. The new manservant left the room. Since his arrival in the house, the new manservant had entertained certain hopes of rising to a position of authority over the other servants. It seemed to him that his superior intellects and greater experience of the world made him a natural lieutenant for the two Mr. Strangers in any difficult business they might have. In his fancy, they had already said to him such things as you know, Jeremy, these are serious matters, and I dare not trust anyone but you with their execution. It would be going too far to say that he immediately abandoned these hopes, but he could not disguise from himself that Jonathan Strange had not seemed greatly pleased to discover someone in his private apartment pouring wine from his private supply. Thus, the new manservant entered Lawrence Strange's writing room with fledgling ambition frustrated and spirits dangerously irritated. Mr. Strange drank the second glass of sherry straight down and remarked that he thought he would have another. At this, the new manservant gave a sort of strangled shout, pulled his own hair, and cried out, "Then why in God's name, you old fool, did you not say so in the first place? I could have brought you the bottle." Mr. Strange looked at him in surprise and said mildly that of course there was no need to bring another glass if it was such a world of trouble to him. The new manservant went back to the kitchen, wondering as he did so if in fact he had been a little curt. A few minutes later, the bell sounded again. Mr. Strange was sitting at his desk with a letter in his hand, looking out through the window at the pitch-black rainy night. "There is a man that lives up on the hill opposite," he said, "and this letter, Jeremy, must be delivered to him before break of day." "Ah," thought the new manservant, "how quickly it begins. An urgent piece of business that must be conducted under the cover of night. What can it mean, except that already he has begun to prefer my assistance to that of the others? Greatly flattered, he declared eagerly that he would go straight away, and took the letter which bore only the enigmatic legend, Wyvern. He inquired if the house had a name, so that he might ask someone if he missed his way. Mr. Strange began to say that the house had no name, and then he stopped himself and laughed.
"You must ask for Wyvern of Heartbreak Farm," he said.
He told the new manservant that he must leave the high road by a broken wicket that stood opposite Blackstock's alehouse. Behind the wicket, he would find a path that would take him straight to Heartbreak Farm. So the new manservant fetched a horse and a stout lantern and rode out onto the high road. It was a dismal night. The air was a great confusion of noisy wind and bitter driving rain, which got into all the gaps in his clothing so that he was very soon chilled to death. The path that began opposite Blackstock's alehouse and wound up the hill was fearfully overgrown. Indeed, it scarcely deserved the name of path, for young saplings grew in the middle of it, which the strong wind took and turned into rods to lash the new manservant as he struggled past. By the time he had travelled half a mile, he felt as if he had fought several strong men, one after the other, and being a hot-headed sort of person who was always getting into quarrels in public places, it was a sensation perfectly familiar to him. He cursed Wyvern for a negligent, idle fellow who could not even keep his hedges in order. It was only after an hour or so that he reached a place which might have been a field once, but which was now a wilderness of briars and brambles, and he began to regret that he had not brought an axe with him. He left the horse tied to a tree and tried to push his way through. The thorns were large, sharp, and plentiful. Several times he found himself pinned into the briar bushes in so many places and in such an elaborate fashion, an arm up here, a leg twisted behind him, that he began to despair of ever getting out again. It seemed odd that anyone could live behind such a high hedge of thorns, and he began to think that it would be no great surprise to discover that Mr. Wyvern had been asleep for 100 years or so. Well, I shall not mind that so much, he thought, so long as I'm not expected to kiss him. As a sad grey dawn broke over the hillside, he came upon a ruined cottage, which did not seem so much to have broken its heart as its neck. The chimney wall sagged outwards in a great bow, and the chimney tottered above it. A landslide of stone tiles from the roof had left holes where the timbers showed like ribs. Elder trees and thorn bushes filled the interior, and in the vigour of their growth had broken all the windows and pushed the doors out of the door frames. The new manservant stood in the rain for some time, contemplating this dismal sight. On looking up, he saw someone striding down the hillside towards him, a fairy tale figure with a large and curious hat upon his head and a staff in his hand. As the figure drew closer, it proved to be a yeoman farmer, a sensible-looking man whose fantastic appearance was entirely due to his having folded a piece of canvas about his head to keep the rain off. He greeted the new manservant thus,
"Man, what have you done to yourself? You're all over blood, and your good clothes are in tatters."
The new manservant looked down at himself and discovered this was true. He explained that the path was overgrown and full of thorns. The farmer looked at him in amazement.
"But there is a good road," he cried, "not a quarter of a mile to the west, that you could have walked in half the time. Who in the world directed you to come by that old path?"
The new manservant did not answer, but instead asked if the farmer knew where Mr. Wyvern of Heartbreak Farm might be found.
"Well, that is Wyvern's cottage, but he's been dead 5 years. Heartbreak Farm, you say? Who told you it was called that? Someone has been playing tricks upon you. Old paths, Heartbreak Farm indeed. But then I dare say it's a good name as any. Wyvern did indeed break his heart here.
He had the misfortune, poor fellow, to own some land, which a gentleman in the valley took a fancy to. And when Wyvern would not sell it, the gentleman sent ruffians in the middle of the night to dig up all the beans and carrots and cabbages that Wyvern had planted. And when that didn't work, he put lawsuits upon him. Poor Wyvern knew nothing of the law, and could not make head or tail of it." The new manservant thought about this for a moment.
"And I fancy," he said at last, "that I could tell you the name of that gentleman."
"Oh," said the farmer, "anyone could do that." He looked a little closer at the new manservant.
"Man," he said, "you're as white as a milk pudding, and shivering fit to break yourself in pieces."
"I'm cold," said the new manservant. Then the farmer, who said his name was Bulbridge, was very pressing with the new manservant to return with him to his own fireside, where he could warm himself and take something to eat and drink, and perhaps lie down a spell. The new manservant thanked him, but said he was cold. That was all. So Bulbridge led the new manservant back to his horse, by a way which avoided the thorns, and showed him the proper way to the road, and then the new manservant went back to Mr. Strange's house. A bleak white sun rose in a bleak white sky, like an allegorical picture of despair, and as he rode, it seemed to the new manservant that the sun was poor Wyvern, and that the sky was hell, and that Wyvern had been put there by Mr. Strange to be tormented for ever. Upon his return, the other servants gathered about him.
"Ah, lad," cried the butler in his concern, "what a sight you are! Was it the sherry wine, Jeremy? Did you make him angry over the sherry wine?"
The new manservant toppled off the horse onto the ground. He grasped the butler's coat and begged the butler to bring him a fishing rod, explaining that he needed it to fish poor Wyvern out of hell. From this and other such coherent speeches, the other servants quickly deduced that he had taken a cold and was feverish. They put him to bed and sent a man for the physician. But Lawrence Strange got to hear about it, and he sent a second messenger after the first to tell the physician he was not wanted. Next, Lawrence Strange said that he thought he would take some gruel and told the butler that he wanted the new manservant to bring it to him. This prompted the butler to go in search of Mr. Jonathan Strange to beg him to do something. But Jonathan Strange had, it seemed, got up early to ride to Shrewsbury, and was not expected back until the following day. So the servants were obliged to get the new manservant out of bed, dress him, put the tray of gruel into his unresisting hand, and push him through the door. All day long, Mr. Strange maintained a steady succession of minor requests, each of which, and Mr. Strange was most particular about this, was for the new manservant to carry out. By nightfall, the new manservant was as hot to the touch as an iron kettle, and talked wildly of oyster barrels. But Mr. Strange declared his intention of sitting up another night, and said that the new manservant should wait upon him in the writing room. The butler pleaded bravely with his master to let him sit up instead.
"Ah, but you cannot conceive what a fancy I have taken to this fellow," said Mr. Strange, his eyes all bright with dislike, "and how I wish to have him always near me. You think he does not look well? In my opinion, he only wants fresh air."
And so saying, he unfastened the window above his writing table. Instantly, the room became bitter cold, and a handful of snowflakes blew in from outside. The butler sighed and propped the new manservant, who had begun to fall down again, more securely against the wall, and secretly put hand warmers in his pockets. At midnight, the maid went in to take Mr. Strange some gruel. When she returned to the kitchen, she reported that Mr. Strange had found the hand warmers and taken them out and put them on the table. The servants went sorrowfully to bed, convinced that the new manservant would be dead by morning. Morning came. The door to Mr. Strange's writing room was closed. 7 o'clock came, and no one rang the bell for the servant. No one appeared. 8 o'clock came, 9 o'clock, 10. The servants wrung their hands in despair. But what they forgot, what indeed Lawrence Strange had forgot, was that the new manservant was a young, strong man, whereas Lawrence Strange was an old one. And some of what the new manservant had been made to suffer that night, Lawrence Strange had been forced to share. At 7 minutes past 10, the butler and the coachman ventured in together and found the new manservant upon the floor, fast asleep, his fever gone. On the other side of the room, seated at his writing table, was Lawrence Strange, frozen to death. When the events of those two nights became more generally known, there was a great curiosity to see the new manservant, such as there might be to see a dragon slayer or a man who had toppled a giant. Of course, the new manservant was glad to be thought remarkable, and as he told and retold the story, he discovered that what he had actually said to Mr. Strange, when he asked for the third glass of sherry wine, was, "Oh, it may suit you very well now, you wicked old sinner, to abuse honest men and drive them into their graves, but a day is coming, and not far off either, when you shall have to answer for every sigh you have forced from an honest man's breast, every tear you have wrung from a widow's eye." Likewise, it was soon well known in the neighborhood that when Mr. Strange had opened the window with the kind intention of starving the new manservant to death with cold, The new manservant had cried out, "Cold at first, Lawrence Strange, but hot at last. Cold at first, hot at last." A prophetic reference to Mr. Strange's present situation. Chapter 15. How is Lady Pole? January 1808. How is Lady Pole? In every part of the town, and among all stations and degrees of citizen, the question was to be heard. In Covent Garden, at break of dawn, costermongers asked flower girls, "How's Lady Pole?" In Ackerman's in the Strand, Mr. Ackerman himself inquired of his customers, members of the nobility and persons of distinction, whether they had any news of Lady Pole. In the House of Commons, during dull speeches, members of Parliament whispered the question to their neighbours, each regarding Sir Walter out of the corner of his eye as he did so. In Mayfair dressing rooms, in the early hours of the morning, maids begged their mistresses' pardons. "But was Lady Pole at the party tonight? And how is her ladyship?" And so the question went round and round. How is Lady Pole? And, "Oh," came back the reply, "her ladyship is very well, exceedingly well." Which demonstrates the sad poverty of the English language. For her ladyship was a great deal more than well. Next to her ladyship, every other person in the world looked pale, tired, half dead. The extraordinary energy she had exhibited the morning after her resurrection had never left her. When she took her walk, people stared to see a lady get on so fast. And as for the footman, who was meant to attend her, he, poor fellow, was generally many yards in the rear, red-faced and breathless. The Secretary of War, coming out of Drummond's in Charing Cross one morning, was brought into sudden and unexpected conjunction with her ladyship, walking rapidly along the street, and was quite overturned. She helped him to his feet, said she hoped she had not hurt him, and was gone before he could think of a reply. Like every other young lady of 19, Lady Pole was wild for dancing. She would dance every dance at a ball without ever losing her breath, and was dismayed that everyone went away so soon. "It's ridiculous to call such a half-hearted affair a ball," she told Sir Walter. "We have had scarcely 3 hours dancing." And she marvelled, too, at the frailty of the other dancers. "Poor things, I pity them." Her health was drunk by the army, the navy, and the church. Sir Walter Pole was regularly named as the most fortunate man in the kingdom, and Sir Walter himself was quite of the same opinion. Miss Wintertown, poor, pale, sick Miss Wintertown, had excited his compassion. But Lady Pole, in a constant glow of extraordinary good health and happy spirits, was the object of his admiration. When she accidentally knocked the Secretary of War to the ground, he thought it the best joke in the world, and spoke of it to everyone he met. He privately confided to Lady Winsell, his particular friend, that her ladyship was exactly the wife to suit him. So clever, so lively, so everything he could have wished for. He was particularly struck by her independent opinions. "She advised me last week that the government ought not to send money and troops to the King of Sweden, which is what we've decided, but instead to lend our support to the governments of Portugal and Spain, and make these countries the basis of our operations against Bonaparte. At 19, to have thought so deeply upon all manner of things, and to have come to so many conclusions about them. At 19, to contradict all the government so boldly. Of course, I told her that she ought to be in Parliament." Lady Pole united in one person all the different fascinations of beauty, politics, wealth, and magic. The fashionable world had no doubt but that she was destined to become one of its most brilliant leaders. She'd been married almost 3 months now. It was time to embark upon the course that destiny and the fashionable world had marked out for her. Cards were sent out for a magnificent dinner party to be held in the second week of January. The first dinner party of a bride's career is a momentous occasion, entailing a world of small anxieties. The accomplishments which have won her acclaim in the 3 years since she left the schoolroom are no longer enough. It is no longer enough to dress exquisitely, to choose jewels exactly appropriate to the occasion, to converse in French, to play the pianoforte and sing. Now she must turn her attention to French cooking and French wines. Though other people may advise her upon these important matters, her own taste and inclinations must guide her. She is sure to despise her mother's style of entertaining and wish to do things differently. In London, fashionable people dine out 4-5 times a week. However will a new bride, 19 years old and scarcely ever in a kitchen before, think of a meal to astonish and delight such jaded palates? Then, there are the servants. In the new bride's new house, the footmen are all new to their business. If something is needed quickly, candles, a different sort of fork, a heavy cloth in which to carry a hot soup tureen, will they be able to find it? In the case of Lady Pole's establishment, at number 9 Harley Street, the problems were multiplied threefold. Half of the servants were from Northamptonshire, from her ladyship's estate at Great Hitherdon, and half were newly hired in London. And as everybody knows, there is a world of difference between country servants and London servants. It is not a matter of duties, exactly. Servants must cook and clean and fetch and carry in Northamptonshire, just as in London. No, the distinction lies more in the manner in which those duties are carried out. Say a country squire in Northamptonshire visits his neighbour. The visit over, the footman fetches the squire's greatcoat and helps the squire on with it. While he's doing so, it is only natural for the footman to inquire respectfully after the squire's wife. The squire is not in the least offended, and responds with some inquiries of his own. Perhaps the squire has heard that the footman's grandmother fell over and hurt herself while cutting cabbages in her garden, and he wishes to know if she's recovered. The squire and the footman inhabit a very small world, and have known each other from childhood. But in London, this will never do. A London footman must not address his master's guests. He must look as if he did not know there were such things as grandmothers and cabbages in the world. At number 9 Harley Street, Lady Pole's country servants were continually ill at ease, afraid of going wrong and never sure of what was right. Even their speech was found fault with and mocked. Their Northamptonshire accent was not always intelligible to the London servants, who, it must be said, made no very great efforts to understand them. And they used words like guzgogs, sparrowgrass, bettycat, and battle twigs, when they should have said gooseberries, asparagus, she-cat, and earwigs. The London servants delighted in playing tricks on the country servants. They gave Alfred, a young footman, plates of nasty dirty water, and told him it was French soup, and bade him serve it up to the other servants at dinner. Often they gave the country servants messages to pass on to the butcher's boy, the baker, and the lamplighter. The messages were full of London slang, and the country servants could make neither head nor tail of them. But to the butcher's boy, the baker, and the lamplighter, who understood them very well, they were both vulgar and insulting. The butcher's boy punched Alfred in the eye on account of what was said to him, while the London servants hid in the larder to listen and laugh. Naturally, the country servants complained vigorously to Lady Pole, whom they'd known all their lives, about the manner in which they were persecuted. And Lady Pole was shocked to find that all her old friends were unhappy in their new home. But she was inexperienced and uncertain how to proceed. She did not doubt the truth of what the country servant said for a moment, but she feared making matters worse. "What ought I to do, Sir Walter?" she asked.
"Do?" said Sir Walter, in surprise. "Do nothing. Leave it all to Stephen Black. By the time Stephen has finished with them, they'll be all as meek as lambs and as harmonious as blackbirds."
Before his marriage, Sir Walter had had only one servant, Stephen Black, and Sir Walter's confidence in this person knew scarcely any bounds. At number 9 Harley Street, he was called Butler, but his duties and responsibilities extended far beyond the range of any ordinary butler. He dealt with bankers and lawyers on Sir Walter's behalf. He studied the accounts of Lady Pole's estates and reported to Sir Walter upon what he found there. He hired servants and workmen without reference to anyone else. He directed their work and paid bills and wages. Of course, in many households there is a servant who, by virtue of his exceptional intelligence and abilities, is given authority beyond what is customary. But in Stephen's case, it was all the more extraordinary, since Stephen was a Negro. I say extraordinary, for is it not generally the case that a Negro servant is the least regarded person in a household, no matter how hard-working he or she may be, no matter how clever? Yet somehow, Stephen Black had found a way to thwart this universal principle. He had, it is true, certain natural advantages, a handsome face and a tall, well-made figure. It certainly did him no harm that his master was a politician who was pleased to advertise his liberal principles to the world by entrusting the management of his house and business to a black servant. The other servants were a little surprised to find they were put under a black man, a sort of person that many of them had never even seen before. Some were inclined to be indignant at first, and told each other that if he dared to give them an order, they would return him a very rude answer. But whatever their intentions, they discovered that when they were actually in Stephen's presence, they did nothing of the sort. His grave looks, air of authority, and reasonable instructions made it very natural to do whatever he told them. The butcher's boy, the baker, the lamplighter, and other similar new acquaintances of the Harley Street servants showed great interest in Stephen from the first. They asked the Harley Street servants questions about Stephen's mode of life. What did he eat and drink? Who were his friends? Where did he like to go whenever he should happen to be at liberty to go anywhere? When the Harley Street servants replied that Stephen had had 3 boiled eggs for breakfast, the Secretary at War's Welsh valet was a great friend of his, and that he had attended a servants' ball in Wapping the night before, the butcher's boy, the baker, and the lamplighter were most grateful for the information. The Harley Street servants asked them why they wished to know. The butcher's boy, the baker, and the lamplighter were entirely astonished. Did the Harley Street servants really not know? The Harley Street servants really did not. The butcher's boy, the baker, and the lamplighter explained that a rumour had been circulating London for years to the effect that Stephen Black was not really a butler at all. Secretly, he was an African prince, the heir to a vast kingdom, and it was well known that as soon as he grew tired of being a butler, he would return there and marry a princess as black as himself. After this revelation, the Harley Street servants watched Stephen out of the corners of their eyes and agreed among themselves that nothing was more likely. In fact, was not their own obedience to Stephen the best proof of it? For it was hardly likely that such independent, proud-spirited Englishmen and women would have submitted to the authority of a black man, had they not instinctively felt the respect and reverence which a commoner feels for a king. Meanwhile, Stephen Black knew nothing of these curious speculations. He performed his duties diligently, as he had always done. He continued to polish silver, train the footmen in the duties of service à la française, admonish the cooks, order flowers, linen, knives and forks, and do all the 1,001 things necessary to prepare house and servants for the important evening of the magnificent dinner party. When it finally came, everything was as splendid as his ingenuity could make it. Vases of hothouse roses filled the drawing room and dining room and lined the staircase. The dining table was laid with a heavy white damask cloth and shone with all the separate glitters that glass, silver, and candlelight can provide. 2 great Venetian mirrors hung upon the wall, and on Stephen's instruction, these had been made to face each other, so that the reflections doubled and tripled and twice tripled the silver and the glasses and the candles. And when the guests finally sat down to dinner, they appeared to be gently dissolving in a dazzling golden light like a company of the blessed in glory. Chief among the guests was Mr. Norrell. What a contrast now with that period when he had first arrived in London. Then he had been disregarded, a nobody. Now he sat among the highest in the land and was courted by them. The other guests continually directed remarks and questions to him, and seemed quite delighted by his short, ungracious replies. "I do not know whom you mean," or "I have not the pleasure of that gentleman's acquaintance," or "I have never been to the place you mention." Some of Mr. Norrell's conversation, the more entertaining part, was supplied by Mr. Drawlight and Mr. Lascelles. They sat upon either side of him, busily conveying his opinions upon modern magic about the table. Magic was a favourite subject that evening. Finding themselves at one and the same time in the presence of England's only magician and of the most famous subject of his magic, the guests could neither think nor talk of anything else. Very soon they fell to discussing the numerous claims of successful spells which had sprung up all over the country following Lady Pole's resurrection.
"Every provincial newspaper seems to have 2 or 3 reports," agreed Lord Castlereagh. "In the Bath Chronicle the other day, I read about a man called Gibbons in Milsom Street, who awoke in the night because he heard thieves breaking into his house. It seems that this man has a large library of magical books. He tried a spell he knew, and turned the housebreakers into mice."
"Really?" said Mr. Canning. "And what happened to the mice?"
"They all ran away into holes in the wainscoting."
"Ha!" said Mr. Lascelles. "Believe me, my lord, there was no magic. Gibbons heard a noise, feared a housebreaker, said a spell, opened a door, and found not housebreakers, but mice. The truth is, it was mice all along. All of these stories prove false in the end. There's an unmarried clergyman and his sister in Lincoln called Malpas, who have made it their business to look into supposed instances of magical occurrences, and they have found no truth in any of them."
"And they are such admirers of Mr. Norrell, this clergyman and his sister," added Mr. Drawlight enthusiastically.
They are so delighted that such a man has arisen to restore the noble art of English magic. They cannot bear that other people should tell falsehoods and claim to imitate his great deeds. They hate it that other people should make themselves seem important at Mr. Norrell's expense. They feel it as a personal affront. Mr. Norrell has been so kind as to supply them with certain infallible means of establishing beyond a doubt the falsity of all such claims, and Mr. Malpass and Miss Malpass drive about the country in their phaeton, confounding these impostors.
"I believe you are too generous to Gibbons, Mr. Lascelles," said Mr. Norrell in his pedantic fashion. "It is not at all certain that he did not have some malicious purpose in making his false claim. At the very least, he lied about his library. I sent Childermas to see it, and Childermas says there's not a book earlier than 1760. Worthless, quite worthless."
"Yet we must hope," said Lady Pole to Mr. Norrell, "that the clergyman and his sister will soon uncover a magician of genuine ability. Someone to help you, sir."
"Oh, but there is no one," exclaimed Rawlight. "No one at all. You see, in order to accomplish his extraordinary deeds, Mr. Norrell shut himself away for years and years, reading books. Alas, such devotion to the interests of one's country is very rare. I assure you, there is no one else."
"But the clergyman and his sister must not give up their search," urged her ladyship. "I know from my own example how much labour is involved in one solitary act of magic. Think how desirable it would be if Mr. Norrell were provided with an assistant."
"Desirable, yet hardly likely," said Mr. Lascelles.
"The Malpasses have found nothing to suggest that any such person is in existence."
"But by your own account, Mr. Lascelles, they have not been looking," said Lady Pole. "Their object has been to expose false magic, not to find new magicians. It would be very easy for them, as they drive about in their phaeton, to make some inquiries as to who does magic and who has a library. I'm certain they will not mind the extra trouble. They will be glad to do what they can to help you, sir."
This to Mr. Norrell.
"And we shall all hope that they soon succeed, because I think you must feel a little lonely."
In due course, a suitable proportion of the 50 or so dishes was deemed to have been eaten, and the footman took away what was left. The ladies withdrew, and the gentlemen were left to their wine. But the gentlemen found that they had less pleasure in each other's society than usual. They had got to the end of all they had to say about magic. They had no relish for gossiping about their acquaintance, or even politics seemed a little dull. In short, they felt that they should like to have the pleasure of looking at Lady Pole again. And so they told Sir Walter, rather than asked him, that he missed his wife. He replied that he did not. But this was not allowed to be possible. It was well known that newly married gentlemen were never happy apart from their wives. The briefest of absences could depress a new husband's spirits and interfere with his digestion. Sir Walter's guests asked each other if they thought he looked bilious, and they agreed that he did. He denied it. Ah, he was putting a brave face on it, wasn't he? Very good. But clearly it was a desperate case. They would have mercy on him and go and join the ladies. In the corner by the sideboard, Stephen Black watched the gentlemen leave. Three footmen, Alfred, Geoffrey, and Robert, remained in the room.
"Are we to go and serve the tea, Mr. Black?" inquired Alfred innocently.
Stephen Black raised one thin finger as a sign they were to stay where they were, and he frowned slightly to show they were to be silent. He waited until he was sure the gentlemen were out of hearing, and then he exclaimed, "What in the world was the matter with everyone tonight? Alfred, I know that you have not often been in such company as we have tonight, but there is no reason to forget all your training. I was astonished at your stupidity." Alfred mumbled his apologies. "Lord Castlereagh asked you to bring him partridges with truffles. I heard him most distinctly. Yet you brought him a strawberry jelly. What were you thinking of?"
Alfred said something rather indistinct, in which only the word fright was distinguishable.
"You had a fright? What fright?"
"I thought I saw a queer figure standing behind her ladyship's chair."
"Alfred, what are you talking about?"
"A tall person with a head of shining silver hair and a green coat. He was leaning down to look at her ladyship, but the next moment there was no one at all."
"Alfred, look to that end of the room."
"Yes, Mr. Black."
"What do you see?"
"A curtain, Mr. Black."
"And what else?"
"A chandelier."
"A green velvet curtain, and a chandelier ablaze with candles. That was your green-coated, silver-headed person, Alfred. Now go and help Sissy put away the china, and do not be so foolish in future. Stephen Black turned to the next footman. Geoffrey, your behavior was every bit as bad as Alfred's. I swear your thoughts were somewhere else entirely. What have you to say for yourself? Poor Geoffrey did not answer immediately. He was blinking his eyes and pressing his lips together, and generally doing all those things that a man will do when he's trying not to cry.
I'm sorry, Mr. Black, but it was the music that distracted me.
What music? Asked Stephen. There was no music. There, listen, that is the string quartet just starting up in the drawing room. They have not played until now.
Oh, no, Mr. Black. I mean the pipe and fiddle that were playing in the next room all the time the ladies and gentlemen were at dinner. Oh, Mr. Black, it was the saddest music that I ever heard. I thought it would break my heart.
Stephen stared at him in perplexity. I do not understand you, he said. There was no pipe and fiddle. He turned to the last footman, a solid-looking dark-haired man of 40 or so. And Robert, I scarcely know what to say to you. Did we not talk yesterday?
We did, Mr. Black.
Did I not tell you how much I relied upon you to set an example to the others?
Yes, Mr. Black.
Yet half a dozen times this evening, you went to the window. What were you thinking of? Lady Winsell was looking around for someone to bring her a clean glass. Your business was at the table attending to our ladyship's guests, not at the window.
I'm sorry, Mr. Black, but I heard a knocking at the window.
A knocking? What knocking?
Branches beating against the glass, Mr. Black.
Stephen Black made a little gesture of impatience. But, Robert, there is no tree near the house. You know very well there is not.
I thought a wood had grown up around the house, said Robert.
What? Cried Stephen.
Chapter 16. Lost Hope. January 1808. The servants in Harley Street continued to believe that they were haunted by eerie sights and mournful sounds. The cook, John Longridge, and the kitchen maids were troubled by a sad bell. The effect of the bell, explained John Longridge to Stephen Black, was to bring vividly to mind everyone they had ever known who had died, all the good things they had ever lost, and every bad thing which had ever happened to them. Consequently, they had become dejected and low, and their lives were not worth living. Geoffrey and Alfred, the two youngest footmen, were tormented by the sound of the fife and violin, which Geoffrey had first heard on the night of the dinner party. The music always appeared to come from the next room. Stephen had taken them all over the house and proved that nowhere was anyone playing any such instruments. But it did no good. They continued afraid and unhappy. Most bewildering of all, in Stephen's opinion, was the behavior of Robert, the eldest footman. Robert had struck Stephen from the first as a sensible man, conscientious, reliable. In short, the last person in the world to fall prey to imaginary fears. Yet Robert still insisted that he could hear an invisible wood growing up around the house. Whenever he paused in his work, he heard ghostly branches scraping at the walls and tapping upon the windows, and tree roots slyly extending themselves beneath the foundations and prising apart the bricks. The wood was old, said Robert, and full of malice. A traveller in the wood would have as much fear from the trees as from another person hiding there. But, argued Stephen, the nearest wood of any size was 4 miles away, upon Hampstead Heath, and even there the trees were quite domesticated. They did not crowd around people's houses and try to destroy them. Stephen could say what he liked. Robert only shook his head and shivered. Stephen's only consolation was that this peculiar mania had erased all the servants' other differences. The London servants no longer cared that the country servants were slow of speech and had old-fashioned manners. The country servants no longer complained to Stephen that the London servants played tricks upon them and sent them on imaginary errands. All the servants were united by the belief that the house was haunted. They sat in the kitchen after their work was done and told stories of all the other houses that they had ever heard of where there were ghosts and horrors, and of the horrible fates that had befallen the people who lived there. One evening, about a fortnight after Lady Pole's dinner party, they were gathered about the kitchen fire, engaged in this favourite occupation. Stephen soon grew tired of listening to them, and retired to his own little room to read a newspaper. He had not been there for more than a few minutes when he heard a bell ringing. So he put down his newspaper, put on his black coat, and went to see where he was wanted. In the little passageway that connected the kitchen to the butler's room was a little row of bells, and beneath the bells the names of various rooms were neatly inscribed in brown paint. The Venetian drawing room, the yellow drawing room, the dining room, Lady Pole's sitting room, Lady Pole's bedchamber, Lady Pole's dressing room, Sir Walter's study, Sir Walter's bedchamber, Sir Walter's dressing room. Lost hope. Lost hope, thought Stephen. What in the world is that? He had paid the carpenter that very morning for the work in putting up the bells, and he had entered the amount in his account book. To Amos Judd, for putting up 9 bells in the kitchen passageway and painting the names of the rooms beneath, 4 shillings. But now there were 10 bells, and the bell for Lost Hope was ringing violently. Perhaps, thought Stephen, Judd means it as a joke. Well, he shall be fetched back tomorrow and made to put it right. Not knowing quite what else to do, Stephen went up to the ground floor and looked in every room. All were empty. So he climbed the staircase to the first floor. At the top of the staircase was a door which he had never seen before.
"Who's there?"
whispered a voice from behind the door. It was not a voice Stephen knew, and though it was only a whisper, it was curiously penetrating. It seemed to get into Stephen's head by some other means than his ears.
"There is someone upon the stairs," insisted the whispering voice. "Is it the servant? Come here, if you please. I need you."
Stephen knocked and went in. The room was every bit as mysterious as the door. If anyone had asked Stephen to describe it, he would have said it was decorated in the Gothic style, this being the only explanation he could think of to account for its extraordinary appearance. But it had none of the usual Gothic embellishments, such as one might see depicted in the pages of Mr. Ackerman's Repository of the Arts. There were no pointed medieval arches, no intricately carved wood, no ecclesiastical motifs. The walls and floor of the room were of plain grey stone, very worn and uneven in places. The ceiling was of vaulted stone. One small window looked out upon a starlit sky. The window had not so much as a scrap of glass in it, and the winter wind blew into the room. A pale gentleman, with an extraordinary quantity of silvery thistle-down hair, was looking at his reflection in an old cracked mirror with an air of deep dissatisfaction.
"Oh, there you are," he said, glancing sourly at Stephen. "A person may call and call in this house, but no one comes."
"I'm very sorry, sir," said Stephen, "but no one told me you were here."
He supposed the gentleman must be a guest of Sir Walter's or Lady Pole's, which explained the gentleman, but not the room. Gentlemen are often invited to stay in other people's houses. Rooms hardly ever are.
"In what way may I serve you, sir?" asked Stephen.
"How stupid you are," cried the gentleman with the thistle-down hair. "Don't you know that Lady Pole is to attend a ball tonight at my house? My own servant has run off and hidden himself somewhere. How can I appear by the side of the beautiful Lady Pole in this condition?"
The gentleman had cause for complaint. His face was unshaven, his curious hair was a mass of tangles, and he was not dressed but only wrapped in an old-fashioned powdering gown.
"I shall be with you in an instant, sir," Stephen assured him. "But first I must find the means to shave you. You do not happen to know what your servant has done with the razor, I suppose?"
The gentleman shrugged. There was no dressing table in the room. Indeed, there was very little furniture of any description. There was the mirror, an old three-legged milking stool, and a queer carved chair that appeared to be made of bones. Stephen did not quite believe that they were human bones, although they did look remarkably like it. Atop the milking stool, next to a pretty little box, Stephen found a delicate silver razor. A battered pewter basin full of water stood upon the floor. Curiously, there was no fireplace in the room, but only a rusting iron brazier full of hot coals that spilt its dirty ashes on the floor. So Stephen heated the basin of water on the brazier, and then he shaved the gentleman. When he had finished, the gentleman inspected his face and pronounced himself excessively pleased. He removed his gown and stood patiently in his dressing trousers while Stephen massaged his skin with a bristle brush. Stephen could not help but observe that whereas other gentlemen grow red as lobsters under such treatment, this gentleman remained as pale as ever, and the only difference was that his skin took on a whitish glow as of moonlight or mother of pearl. His clothes were the finest Stephen had ever seen. His shirt was exquisitely laundered, and his boots shone like black mirrors. But best of all were a dozen or so white muslin neckcloths, each as thin as a cobweb and as stiff as music paper. It took 2 hours to complete the gentleman's toilet, for he was, Stephen found, extremely vain. During this time, the gentleman became more and more delighted with Stephen.
"I tell you that my own ignorant fellow has not got half your skill at dressing hair," he declared. "And when it comes to the delicate art of tying a muslin neckcloth, why, he cannot be made to understand it at all."
"Well, sir, it is exactly the sort of task I like," said Stephen. "I wish I could persuade Sir Walter to take more care of his clothes, but political gentlemen have no leisure for thinking of such things." Stephen helped the gentleman on with his leaf-green coat, which was of the very best quality and most fashionable cut. Then the gentleman went over to the milking stool and picked up the little box that lay there. It was made of porcelain and silver, and was about the size of a snuff box, but a little longer than snuff boxes generally are. Stephen made some admiring remark about the colour, which was not exactly pale blue, and not exactly grey, not precisely lavender, and not precisely lilac.
"Yes, indeed, it is beautiful," agreed the gentleman enthusiastically, "and very hard to make. The pigment must be mixed with the tears of spinsters of good family, who must live long lives of impeccable virtue, and die without ever having had a day of true happiness."
"Poor ladies," said Stephen. "I'm glad it is so rare."
"Oh, it is not the tears that make it rare. I have bottles full of those. It is the skill to mix the colour."
The gentleman had by now become so affable, so willing to talk, that Stephen had no hesitation in asking him, "And what do you keep in such a pretty little box, sir? Snuff?"
"Oh, no. It is a great treasure of mine that I wish Lady Pole to wear at my ball tonight."
He opened the box and showed Stephen a small white finger. At first, this struck Stephen as a little unusual, but his surprise faded in a moment, and if anyone had questioned him about it just then, he would have replied that gentlemen often carried fingers about with them in little boxes, and that this was just one of many examples he had seen. "Has it been in your family long, sir?" he asked politely.
"No, not long."
The gentleman snapped shut the box and put it in his pocket. Together, he and Stephen admired his reflection in the mirror. Stephen could not help but notice how they perfectly complemented each other. Gleaming black skin next to opalescent white skin, each a perfect example of a particular type of masculine beauty. Exactly the same thought seemed to strike the gentleman.
"How handsome we are," he said in a wondering tone. "But I see now that I have made a horrible blunder. I took you for a servant in this house, but that's quite impossible. Your dignity and handsomeness proclaim you to be of noble, perhaps kingly birth. You are a visitor here, I suppose, as I am. I must beg your pardon for imposing upon you, and thank you for the great service you've done me in making me ready to meet the beautiful Lady Pole."
Stephen smiled. "No, sir, I am a servant. I am Sir Walter's servant." The gentleman with the thistledown hair raised his eyebrow in astonishment.
"A man as talented and handsome as yourself ought not to be a servant," he said in a shocked tone. "He ought to be the ruler of a vast estate. What is beauty for, I should like to know, if not to stand as a visible sign of one's superiority to everyone else? But I see how it is. Your enemies have conspired together to deprive you of all your possessions and to cast you down among the ignorant and lowly."
"No, sir, you are mistaken. I have always been a servant."
"Well, I do not understand it,"
declared the gentleman with the thistledown hair, with a puzzled shake of his head.
"There is some mystery here, and I shall certainly look into it just as soon as I am at liberty. But in the meantime, as a reward for dressing my hair so well and all the other services you have done me, you shall attend my ball tonight."
This was such a very extraordinary proposal that for a moment Stephen did not know quite what to say. "Either he is mad," he thought, "or else he is some sort of radical politician who wishes to destroy all distinctions of rank." Aloud he said, "I am very sensible of the honour you do me, sir, but only consider, your other guests will come to your house expecting to meet ladies and gentlemen of their own rank. When they discover that they are consorting with a servant, I am sure they will feel the insult very keenly. I thank you for your kindness, but I should not wish to embarrass you or offend your friends." This seemed to astonish the gentleman with the thistledown hair even more.
"What nobility of feeling," he cried, "to sacrifice your own pleasure to preserve the comfort of others. Well, it is a thing, I confess, that would never occur to me, and it only increases my determination to make you my friend and do everything in my power to aid you. But you do not quite understand. These guests of mine, on whose account you are so scrupulous, they are all my vassals and subjects. There is not one of them who would dare to criticize me or anyone I chose to call my friend. And if they did, why, we could always kill them. But really," he added, as if he were suddenly growing bored of this conversation, "there is very little use debating the point, since you are already here."
With that, the gentleman walked away, and Stephen found that he was standing in a great hall where a crowd of people were dancing to sad music. Once again, he was a little surprised, but as before, he grew accustomed to the idea in a moment and began to look about him. Despite all that the gentleman with the thistledown hair had said upon the point, he was a little apprehensive at first that he would be recognized. A few glances about the room were enough to reassure him that there were no friends of Sir Walter present. Indeed, there was no one Stephen had ever seen before, and in his neat black clothes and clean white linen, he believed he might very easily pass for a gentleman. He was glad that Sir Walter had never required him to wear livery or a powdered wig, which would have marked him out as a servant in an instant. Everyone was dressed in the very height of fashion. The ladies wore gowns of the most exquisite colours, though to own the truth, very few of them were colours that Stephen could remember having seen before. The gentlemen wore knee breeches and white stockings and coats of brown, green, blue, and black. Their linen was a sparkling, shining white, and their kid gloves had not so much as a stain or mark upon them. But in spite of all the fine clothes and gaiety of the guests, there were signs that the house was not so prosperous as once it had been. The room was dimly lit by an insufficient number of tallow candles, and there was just one viol and one fife to provide the music. "That must be the music that Godfrey and Alfred spoke of," thought Stephen. "How odd that I could not hear it before. It is every bit as melancholy as they said." He made his way to a narrow, unglazed window and looked out upon a dark, tangled wood under starlight. "And this must be the wood which Robert talks about. How malevolent it looks. And is there a bell, I wonder?"
"Oh, yes," said a lady who was standing close by. She wore a gown the color of storms, shadows, and rain, and a necklace of broken promises and regrets. He was surprised to find himself addressed by her, since he was quite certain that he had not spoken his thoughts out loud. "There is indeed a bell," she told him. "It is high up in one of the towers."
She was smiling and regarding him with such frank admiration that Stephen thought it only polite to say something. "This is certainly a most elegant assembly, madam. I do not know when I last saw so many handsome faces and graceful figures gathered together in one place, and every one of them in the utmost bloom of youth. I confess that I am surprised to see no older people in the room. Have these ladies and gentlemen no mothers and fathers, no aunts or uncles?"
"What an odd remark," she replied, laughing. "Why should the master of Lost Hope House invite aged and unsightly persons to his ball? Who would want to look at them? Besides, we are not so young as you suppose. England was nothing but dreary wood and barren moor when last we saw our sires and dams. But wait, see? There is Lady Pole."
Between the dancers, Stephen caught a glimpse of her ladyship. She was wearing a blue velvet gown, and the gentleman with the thistledown hair was leading her to the top of the dance. Then the lady in the gown of colour of storm, shadows, and rain inquired if he would like to dance with her. "Gladly," he said. When the other ladies saw how well Stephen danced, he found he could have any partner he wished for. After the lady in the gown the colour of storms, shadows, and rain, he danced with a young woman who had no hair, but who wore a wig of shining beetles that swarmed and seethed upon her head. His third partner complained bitterly whenever Stephen's hand happened to brush against her gown. She said it put her gown off its singing, and when Stephen looked down, he saw that her gown was indeed covered with tiny mouths, which opened and sang a little tune in a series of high, eerie notes. Although in general the dancers followed the usual custom and changed partners at the end of two dances, Stephen observed that the gentleman with the thistledown hair danced with Lady Pole the whole night long, and that he scarcely spoke to any other person in the room. But he had not forgotten Stephen. Whenever Stephen chanced to catch his eye, the gentleman with the thistledown hair smiled and bowed his head and gave every sign of wishing to convey that of all the delightful circumstances of the ball, what pleased him most was to see Stephen Black there.